Hello and welcome back to the Gubba Podcast. I'm Gubba, a first-time homesteader following in the footsteps of my homesteading forebears. In this podcast, I talk about homesteading, prepping, and everything in between. Today, I want to dive into the fascinating and rewarding world of beekeeping. Whether you are a complete beginner or simply curious about what it takes to start a hive, then this episode is for you. Bees are simply amazing, and we will cover everything from choosing the right breed of bees to maintaining a healthy colony, maximizing honey production, and understanding the various products that bees produce. Spoiler alert, they produce more than just honey because they are just the most incredible, so cool creatures. I love having them on my homestead. And whenever I share my beekeeping adventures online, I get so many questions about it. So I thought I would dedicate an entire podcast episode to it. So let's dive in. So like I said, bees are these incredible creatures. And especially if you are beekeeping, you get to see them up close and personal. But bees play an essential role in our ecosystem, pollinating crops and wild plants that provide our food and our oxygen. So without bees, agriculture would suffer huge and biodiversity would decline at an alarming rate, which we're kind of seeing these things. But keeping bees not only allows you to enjoy the rewards of honey and other hive products, but it also contributes to environmental sustainability. I really feel like here on Earth, we are in such a collapse right now, but many people also find beekeeping to be a deeply fulfilling and even therapeutic hobby like I do, while others turn it into a thriving business by selling honey and the other bee-related products. In recent years, though, growing concerns over declining bee populations have made beekeeping more crucial than ever, and supporting our pollinators, whether that's by beekeeping or simply by planting pollinator-friendly gardens, helps to sustain the health of our ecosystems and the bees and ensure stable food supplies for the future. So food for the bees, which then turns into food for us. The decline in bee populations has been a growing concern lately. Bees, like I mentioned, play a crucial role in pollinating crops and wild plants, and their disappearance poses a significant threat to food production and that biodiversity that we need. I remember growing up and seeing all kinds of different pollinators, and now I hardly see any. It's noticeable. Butterflies used to be so common, and now my spring and summer months are barren of butterflies. I hardly see them, and that makes me sad. And there's also different kinds of bees that I would see, and I don't see them anymore either. And researchers have proposed several theories to explain the decline. There's no single cause. I personally think it is a range from habitat loss, pesticide exposure to quote-unquote climate change, and diseases, whether these diseases are natural or introduced. I just have my own suspicions, and these theories are often overlapping and interconnected. They help us understand the complex challenges that bees and pollinators face and what can be done to hopefully mitigate their decline. I also remember going on road trips when I was younger, and the vehicle would be completely covered in bugs, like the front bumper, the whole entire windshield. Like, we would have to stop multiple times to get all the bugs off. That's not happening anymore. You should let me know if you have experienced this as well in your area, because like I said, I don't see pollinators like I used to. And going on road trips, like, my car is not covered in bugs like it used to be. One of the most widely discussed theories behind the bee population decline, and what I would say is just the overall bug and pollinator decline, is the extensive use of pesticides. particularly neonicotinoids. These systemic insecticides, which are absorbed by plants and found in nectar and pollen, have been shown to have harmful effects on bees. So studies suggest that the neonicotinoids impair bees' ability to navigate, forage, and reproduce. Even sublethal doses can weaken immune systems, making bees more susceptible to diseases. Other chemicals such as fungicides and herbicides may also contribute to bee mortality by reducing the availability of flowering plants that provide food, or by interacting with other stressors in unforeseen ways. And so one thing that pops into my mind that we have been trained to think is that the dandelion is a weed and we need to spray them with Roundup. That could not be further from the truth. Dandelions are a medicinal plant, with every part being edible. Dandelions are also one of the first foods for bees coming out of winter. So the whole population has been trained to spray the bees' food. So you see how this whole ridiculous problem is causing serious issues. So of course the bees are going to be dropping like flies. They just went through this stressful time of winter and they're coming out, they're foraging, and they're like, hey, there's a dandelion, let me go and forage on it. And it's been sprayed with Roundup, and then the Roundup just completely annihilates their system. We are spraying their food. We are effectively causing this bee decline. So don't fall for the propaganda. Don't spray your dandelions. I will also put a video in the show notes where last spring I harvested dandelions and I went through the health benefits of each part of the dandelion. Dandelions are so cool. It's no wonder the system has brainwashed us to spray them, because they are medicinal. They are one of the most medicinal plants, and they're free and they are all over the place. So when you think about the system and how the system operates, of course they are going to brainwash everybody into thinking you need to spray them. But for another reason of why there has been such a big sharp bee decline in population is climate change, quote unquote. So climate change has disrupted natural ecosystems, altering the availability of food sources and suitable habitat for bees. So we have these rising temperatures, shifting bloom cycles, and erratic weather patterns, which have thrown off the delicate synchronization between bees and the plants they pollinate. So for example, if flowers bloom earlier due to warmer winters, but bees are still in hibernation, they miss crucial feeding opportunities. Similarly, extreme weather events such as droughts, heat waves, and storms can devastate bee populations by destroying their colonies or limiting floral resources. We know why this is happening, right? You only have to look up in the sky to see the quote unquote climate change taking place. It looks like long streaks of smudge behind airplanes. Weather manipulation has literally been admitted to. You just have to look into it. So we have the bees taking a beating on their food. We have the bees taking a beating on their environment. And then there is another thing that bee populations are struggling with, and that is an increase in parasites and pathogens, particularly the Varroa destructor mite. This parasitic mite attaches itself to honeybees and feeds on their bodily fluids, and that weakens the bees and transmits ailments like the deformed wing virus. And once introduced into a colony, Varroa mites can quickly decimate the bee populations. I actually lost one of my first hives from this. So they are a very real issue, these parasites and pathogens. Poor nutrition and exposure to pesticides further compromise bees' immune systems, making them more vulnerable to these pathogens. You can apply treatment to your hives for the mites in the form of oxalic acid and formic acid. I'm not a huge fan of these. There's these warning labels, and you're told, oh, these are all natural, but the most all natural way that you can treat these mites is with powdered sugar. So when the bees are dusted with powdered sugar, they become more inclined to clean themselves, to groom themselves, and groom the other bees, which is really cool. And this helps dislodge the mites from their bodies. The mites then fall through the hive screen bottom board and out of the colony. The fine sugar particles also coat the mites, making it harder for them to cling to the bees. This increases the chance of them falling off the bees. So keep this in mind when you're starting your hives. Most every beekeeper uses one of the acids. I find it interesting that a problem has been introduced and then a product is sold to deal with the problem. Makes you wonder where this problem really came from. This also reminds me of chronic wasting disease, which is a fatal neurodegenerative disease that affects deer, elk, moose, and so these wildlife that people hunt for food, right? So it was first identified in 1967 in a captive mule deer in Colorado, and it said that it was due to a spontaneous prion mutation. And I just don't think that I buy it, because he who controls the food controls the people. So it makes sense if you wanted to have more control over the population, things are going to start getting twisted with the food. But back to bees and why their population is declining, this is just important to know. So then you can be aware of your environment, what you have going on. But some studies suggest that electromagnetic radiation from cell towers and wireless technology may be disrupting bees' ability to navigate. So bees rely on the Earth's magnetic fields and their own internal biological compasses to find food sources and return to their hive. Increased exposure to electromagnetic fields has been linked to disorientated navigation, colony stress, and lower reproductive success in bees. I would love to find a study of bees and their populations and what that looks like as more 5G towers have began to be built. It'd be fascinating to study hives at different distances from 5G towers. I mean, they are popping up everywhere. It really is up to the beekeepers to keep the bee population strong. And while each of these theories contributes to bee population decline, it is likely that a combination of these factors is driving the entire crisis. You can only do your best as the beekeeper and hope for the best for your bees. But again, it's just important to know these things ahead of time so you know what you're getting yourself into. You can be aware of your environment, what your bees' needs are. So let's discuss the best kind of bees to start out with. You're getting into beekeeping. There are many kinds of breeds of bees, and you don't want to just randomly pick a breed if you are just starting out. When it comes to choosing bees, not all breeds are created equal, and selecting the right one can have a significant impact on your success as a beekeeper. Italian bees are among the most popular choices. They are favored for their gentle temperament, strong honey production, and excellent disease resistance, making them ideal for beginners, especially because of that gentle temperament. Carniolan bees are another excellent choice, particularly for colder climates. So this is what I started with. Two hives of Carniolans. I now have Carniolan Italian mixes, and Carniolan bees build up their populations quickly in the spring and are generally gentle, though they have a tendency to swarm more frequently than Italian bees. And this is absolutely true. I've had a lot of swarms of my Carniolans. Russian bees are highly resistant to mites and other pests, making them a great option for those looking for more a self-sufficient colony, though they can be slightly more aggressive than the Italians and Carniolans. Buckfast bees, developed for hardiness and productivity, are also relatively docile and resistant to disease. However, Africanized bees are not recommended for beginners, as they are highly defensive and require experienced handling. So Selecting the right breed depends on various factors, including your climate, experience level, and your beekeeping goals. So for most beginners, Italian or Carniolan bees are the best choices, and I have loved mine. Starting a beekeeping operation requires careful planning, research, and an initial investment. The most critical component is the beehive itself. A basic Langstroth hive, which is what I have, consists of stacked boxes known as supers, each containing removable frames where the bees build their comb. Other hive types include the top bar and the war hives, which offer different management styles but require more experience to maintain effectively. I started with Langstroth and I am heading into my fourth year with them, so they work pretty well for what I need. If I get more time down the road, I might venture out, but I'm just happy with how it works out here on my homestead. Protective gear is also essential for beekeepers, including a bee suit, gloves, and a veil to prevent stings. Beekeeping tools such as a smoker, which calms the bees. So when you open up the hive, you'll use your smoker so they move and they get away from the smoke. A hive tool for separating frames and a bee brush for gently removing bees are necessary for hive management. I use all of these and I utilize these tools during my hive checks, and securing a source of bees is going to be your next step after you get your equipment, which can be done by purchasing bees from local beekeepers or suppliers, or by capturing a wild swarm. I would suggest joining local beekeeping groups, as people will post where to purchase bees locally, or if someone is selling a swarm or a hive split. You can learn about beekeeping strategies that are pertinent to your area in these groups. My beekeeping in a northern climate will look a bit different than beekeeping in a southern warm climate, so local groups will be a wealth of knowledge to you. Also, in considering your beehive, location is a key thought for when you are planning. A good beekeeping site should provide access to plenty of flowering plants nearby, a clean water source, and some protection from strong winds. Seriously, I cannot believe some people just set their hives on cement blocks and call it good. I have built wooden stands that allow airflow, and I strap down the hives to the stands when there is a storm, and I have some straps that I put into the ground for my stands when there is a storm. They are heavy, so the hives are really heavy, but I never want to risk them blowing away from a strong gust. And the cost of setting up a beehive can range from $200 to $500, depending on the type of equipment and bees that you purchase. So I see a lot of bee equipment go up for sale in the fall at the end of the season for a discounted rate. That is the best time to shop at the end of the season when people are like, oh, I don't want to beekeep. But also right now, beginning of season, when people are not wanting to beekeep and they are trying to get rid of their equipment for cheap. So you can check out Craigslist, you can check out those local groups. So that is something to keep in mind. If you buy all new, it will be more expensive. And once your hive is established, regular maintenance is necessary to keep your bees healthy and productive. Routine hive inspections are essential for checking for diseases, pests, and ensuring that the queen is actively laying eggs. In times of nectar shortages, particularly in early spring, supplemental feeding with sugar syrup may be recommended to help the bees sustain themselves near area. I will be honest, I did not supplement feed with sugar water last year against what most beekeepers are told and what they do in my area, and my honey turned out better than ever. It just tasted so much better because they were then having to be active with forage sugars instead of the white table sugar to supplement feed. So it was more natural and the honey was night and day. And pest control, like we talked about, was one of the most significant challenges in beekeeping. The varroa mites, the hive beetles, and wax moths are common threats that require diligent monitoring and treatment strategies. Mice can also be a problem. So it is important to elevate your hives, in my opinion. Another challenge beekeepers face is swarm prevention. So bees naturally swarm when their hive becomes overcrowded, leading to the loss of part of the colony. So the queen will start laying queen eggs, and then she will take most of the colony with her. But then the strongest queen will hatch and then keep that colony going behind. So regular inspections, adding extra space within the hive, and splitting colonies when necessary can help prevent swarming. And trust me, they will swarm when you are least expecting it. I had two hives swarm last year, but I was able to catch them because they will head for a nearby tree or high point before they take off further to a bigger high point, like way miles away. So you just find the queen, scoop her into some frames, and the bees will follow. I gave two swarms away last year, so they swarmed, I caught them, I gave away. And by maintaining a regular inspection schedule and responding to potential issues quickly, beekeepers increase their chances of sustaining a strong colony year around. Keep in mind, if you live in an area with winters like I do, you do have to overwinter your bees. And how I do that is I insulate my bees, I leave plenty of honey for them, and I put a moisture absorber in there, and I leave them some fondant in case they run out of their honey and then they have an extra food source. So that is how I have had good luck with keeping my bees over winter. But one of the most exciting aspects of beekeeping is harvesting the valuable products that bees produce. Honey is the most well-known and widely used, serving as a natural sweetener with antibacterial properties, often used in foods, skincare, and medicinal applications. Beyond honey, beekeepers can harvest propolis, a resin-like substance, and propolis has strong antimicrobial properties and is frequently used in natural medicine. You have beeswax, is another valuable product commonly used in making candles, balms, and cosmetics. It is harvested by melting down old honeycomb, filtering out impurities, and shaping it into the useful forms, like those lovely balms and the candles. You also have royal jelly, which is a nutrient-rich secretion used to feed developing queen bees, and is often marketed as a dietary supplement due to its high nutritional content. You also have pollen, which is collected by bees and stored as a protein source. It is highly sought after for its rich supply of vitamins and minerals. Bee pollen is where I get my trace minerals by sprinkling on my smoothies and yogurt. Learning how to harvest and utilize these products can make beekeeping even more rewarding and financially beneficial if you turn your beekeeping into a business. Honey is typically harvested once or twice a year, depending on climate, nectar flow, and hive strength. The best time to collect honey is in the late summer or early fall, after the bees have had ample time to produce and store enough for both themselves and for collection. It's crucial to ensure that the colony has sufficient honey reserves to survive winter. I leave about 10 full frames of honey for my hives for the winter. The average is to have 100 pounds of honey for the bees to survive winter, so keep that in mind. To harvest honey, you first check the frames inside the hive during hive inspection. Honey is stored in the hive supers within the wooden frames, and bees cap ripe honey with a thin layer of wax. You will know when it's ready for harvest when at least 80% of the honeycomb cells are capped. Before extracting the honey, bees need to be gently removed from the frames. So this is done using bee escape boards to encourage the bees to vacate the frames. During this time, bees can be a bit temperamental as they are protecting their crop and what they work so hard for. So once you have the frames and have brushed them away of any bees, you uncap the honeycomb by carefully removing the wax caps, covering the honey cells with an uncapping knife or fork. I have this heated knife that just cuts right down and then I extract the honey. The exposed frames are then placed in a honey extractor, a centrifuge that spins the frames and pulls honey out of the comb. It's pretty fun and cool. I shared bits of this process last season online, and the honey flows down to a collection bucket through a strainer that removes wax particles. And once filtered, the honey is allowed to sit so any air bubbles rise to the top, and then it is bottled for storage or for sale. I personally don't sell my honey. I just give it away as gifts and use it for cooking and food storage. Honey harvesting requires patience and balance, taking enough for yourself and family while ensuring the bees have plenty to sustain themselves through the colder months. When it comes to harvesting propolis, which is amazing, propolis, which is often called bee glue, is collected throughout the active beekeeping season, but is typically harvested in late summer, early fall, when the colony has built up a sufficient amount. Bees use propolis to seal cracks in the hive, reinforce structures, and prevent disease. Whenever I'm doing hive checks, sometimes I have to split open the hives where they have already sealed, and I will harvest that propolis just by scraping it off. It's never generally a ton, but I'm hoping to harvest more this coming season. The easiest way to harvest propolis is by using a propolis trap, which is a plastic or mesh insert that encourages bees to fill gaps with propolis. And once the trap is full, it is placed in the freezer, making the propolis brittle and easy to remove. Another method is scraping propolis directly from hive frames and wooden components during regular inspections, which is what I do, which I already mentioned. Since raw propolis contains bee parts and debris, it is often cleaned by breaking it into small pieces and soaking it in alcohol or water to dissolve impurities. Some people do that. I just eat it raw and unfiltered. I feel like more natural, the better. And once purified, it is dried and stored in an airtight container. Propolis is highly valued for its antibacterial and antifungal properties and is often used in natural medicine and skincare products, especially for immune boosting properties that it has. You also have beeswax in the hives, and beeswax is a byproduct for honey extraction and can be collected whenever honey is harvested or during hive maintenance. Worker bees produce wax to build honeycomb, and when honeycomb is extracted, the wax cups removed during the uncapping process can be saved for later use. To process beeswax, you collect the wax cappings and place them in a double boiler, which gently heats the wax until it liquefies. The melted wax is then strained through cheesecloth or a fine mesh sieve to remove bee parts and debris. Once purified, the wax is poured into molds or blocks to solidify, making it easier to store and use for later applications. So you can make small little blocks, big blocks, just depending on what you are crafting. Beeswax is incredibly versatile and is widely used in skincare and candle making and woodworking. You also have royal jelly, which is harvested in spring and early summer when bee colonies are actively raising new queens, if that's what you are doing. It is a thick, milky secretion produced by worker bees and is used exclusively to feed developing queen larvae. This nutrient-dense substance plays a crucial role in transforming an ordinary larva into a queen bee. I personally have never harvested it, but I could have from my hives that have swarmed. So to collect royal jelly, you stimulate queen rearing by placing artificial queen cups in the hive, and worker bees will deposit royal jelly inside these cells to feed the potential new queens. And after 2 to 3 days, the cells contain enough royal jelly to be harvested. You then scoop out the jelly using a small spoon or suction device. Since royal jelly is highly perishable, it must be stored refrigerated or frozen in airtight containers to maintain its potency. It is prized for its nutritional benefits and anti-aging properties and is commonly used in supplements and cosmetics. Again, this isn't one that I have done, mostly because people doing royal jelly, they're like specializing in that with their hives. And I'm just here letting my hives do their own thing. And then I collect honey and the other byproducts. We also have bee pollen, which is collected throughout the foraging season, typically from spring through early fall when bees are actively gathering pollen from flowers. This nutrient-dense substance contains proteins, vitamins, and antioxidants and is often used as a dietary supplement. I use it. And to harvest bee pollen, you install a pollen trap at the entrance of the hive. So as the bees return carrying pollen in sacks on their legs, the trap gently knocks some pollen off, collecting it in a tray. Since fresh bee pollen is highly perishable, it is removed from the trap daily to prevent moisture buildup. It is then spread on trays and air-dried or freeze-dried to preserve its nutritional value. And once dried, bee pollen is stored in an airtight container in a cool, dark place or frozen for long-term storage. I just store mine in the fridge. Also, the last bee product you may not have thought of and I haven't mentioned until now is bee venom. So bee venom has been used in natural medicine for centuries, particularly in Chinese medicine and apitherapy. Modern research is beginning to validate many of its potential health benefits. Not that we need, you know, paid off researchers to validate anything, but this is leading to the development of bee venom based treatments for a variety of conditions. Bee venom is composed of enzymes, peptides, and amino acids, with its most notable active compound being melittin, which has powerful anti-inflammatory and antimicrobial properties. Other key compounds such as apamin, atolopin, and phospholipase A2 contribute to its therapeutic effects. Bee venom therapy has shown promise in supporting immune function. It's seriously so cool. It has shown promise in reducing inflammation and even aiding in pain management. I know there are people who share their journey with Lyme disease, arthritis, and other health ailments, and how bee venom therapy helps them heal. So whenever I get stung by my bees, I do have an allergic reaction. I swell, and it can be a bit nerve-wracking because of how much I swell. Like, I keep in mind that if I was stung in the neck, I would need to remove the stinger right away, because when you are stung, there's a muscle that keeps pumping venom into you. I would need to apply bentonite clay right away to dry out the venom and maybe take some holistic bug bite meds. Like, what is my body reacting to? Why is it such a harsh reaction? Did you know that peanut allergies started to become more common after they put peanut oil as an adjuvant in vaccines? I found this interesting and wonder what my body is doing with the venom. Is there possibly any correlation for me to have such a huge reaction to bee venom? So yes, I am allergic to bee venom, but I keep bees and I hang out with my bees without gear 95% of the time. I'm just out there hanging by the hives because it's so relaxing. And even if you are not ready to become a beekeeper, there are still ways to support pollinators, planting native wildflowers, not using pesticides, like letting those dandelions flourish in the spring, and providing water sources for pollinators all contribute to their well-being. Creating those bee-friendly environments, even in urban areas, helps support them. You can also support local beekeepers by purchasing raw honey and bee products. That's another excellent way to contribute to the overall pollinator health where you live. Many people are unaware that commercial honey production often involves harmful practices such as over-harvesting, feeding bees sugar substitutes, and using harsh chemical treatments in the hives. So by choosing local, responsibly harvested honey, you support local beekeepers who care about the art of beekeeping, and you support your body because local honey will always be superior to imported mystery honey from the store that is often watered down or has high fructose corn syrup in it. So beekeeping is rewarding. It's educational and an incredible homestead activity. If you are considering getting started, now is the time. Find your local beekeeping groups and just jump in. Just start learning. Start small. Learn from your experiences, your failures, your successes, and gradually expand as you gain confidence. I started with 2 hives and I am now at 4. I realized 4 is the perfect amount for my homestead maintenance-wise. Whether you are interested in beekeeping for honey production, pollination benefits, or simply the joy of working with bees, there is something incredibly fulfilling about tending to a hive. Bees also emit a healing frequency, so that is why I hang out by them all of the time. Supposedly, beekeepers live longer than the average person. So thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode. I hope it was helpful. Be sure to subscribe for more homesteading tips, and I appreciate you spending your time here, and I will see you next time. Bye!